Station number 13420.
3-4. In front were spotters for the artillery, and indeed this applied to us. Now, we had stacked ammunition by the side of the tank, and then we were given the order to train the guns so that we disengaged the gun itself so that it was level, re-engage, and there were the whole 163 tanks had done the same thing. So when the spotter gave the order up two, that meant lifting the gun two turns, or right two, that was two turns that way, you had 163 guns in tandem, moving exactly, doing it together. And similar, as I say, with harmonising with all this lot behind us, it was just a solid wall of steel behind which the infantry were advancing. We were then told to stand down about 6:30, by which time the rifling of our barrels were gone, finished. The idea was then to go back and get new barrels, so I'm led to believe. We had spare crews outside. The gunner would do his stint. He would move across then and do the loading, and then he would hop out and another chap would come in. But the air was absolutely foul with cordite fume, because the fan, it wasn't strong enough to clear the air in the tank. And consequently, it didn't take long to be overcome by the fumes. But in the process, you, as long as you were able, you were firing and getting rid of as many shells as you could. Well, as I say, we stood down about 6:30. We had breakfast, cooking the breakfast in the round the back. And by this time, we had a commander with us by the name of Captain Martin, who had actually been made up an officer on the field. Now, he had come from the ERYs, and he was a great chap. Never afraid to turn his hand to whatever want he was doing on the tank. So after breakfast, he said, "Right, chaps, come on. You two give us a hand to store this spare ammunition, as which will be going back soon." So one of the lads went inside the tank, he stood on the top, and I'm on the ground passing up these shells to him. The next thing that I remember, there was just a soft swish, which apparently came from a sniper that had been stuck in the tree for I don't know how long, and it struck the shell that Captain Martin was holding. Well, it blew him off the tank, and it compound multiple fraction of his arm and his leg. And his tummy was in a mess. As look at it, somebody had said something to me, and I said, "You up?" and turned my head, and I got the blast in my face, which blew me 2 or 3 feet. And I wound up, when I'd been seen to by the medic, I wound up looking like the Invisible Man, and I was breathing through a little spool of plaster through the teeth. Well, I lost all interest in the war then, as you can imagine. We shipped back and spent a night, a large hall as I remember, but I couldn't see anything, but I knew it was high because of the acoustics in Sutogenbosch. And then the following morning, we were shipped on a hospital train down to Beaverloo, I think, somewhere just outside Ghent. And then eventually I shipped back to a holding unit. Oh, I was in convalescence for quite some time at a place called Canokke-le-Zoute, which is a Belgian summer resort. And then to a holding unit at Dépane further up the coast, Newport, Dupin, not south of Ostend. And eventually I got back to the regiment. By this time, they had been in the battle for Bremen and wound up at Bremervoorde. Because in the interim, which all I missed all that, they'd cleared the Reichswald, they'd cleared the Rhine and the Rhine crossing, and as I say, they'd done Bremen, and they wound up at Bremervoorde, not too far from Bremerhaven. And I rejoined them there on the 4th of May. And as you know, peace was declared on the 8th of May. The next step then was to attend the victory parade of the 51st Highland Div and us through Bremerhaven. From there, we moved across to the Elbe. HQ squadron went to Buxtehude. My squadron, C squadron, went to a little village called Borstel, which sits right on the Elbe, opposite Blankenese. And for 6 weeks, we became human beings again.
Whilst you were there at Borstel, did you come across the Russians?
No, we were on the opposite side to Hamburg, and that's where we stayed. We just sheeted the tanks up after having got them serviceable, and there were guard duties to be carried out, certain patrols, for what reason I don't know. But in the main, we just became human beings. Being cavalry, they confiscated several hunters, and we were all allowed, made to ride. The sergeant major, he'd been a regular soldier, a remount rider in India with all that kind of experience behind him. So he got us to do that, and eventually we were able to go in for gymkhanas and the like. Lots of swimming on the Elbe.
What were relations like with the German population?
Well, first of all, when I tell you that the youngest man in Borstel would be about 76. And this was the time of the no fraternization. Suffice to say, and we were living in civvy billets, we soon were able to have our laundry done and that kind of thing. And it's amazing how well chocolate, cigarettes and bars of soap were used to good effect.
So you ignored the no fraternization order?
Practically.
What did the officers think about that?
Oh, well, it was a case of what the eye doesn't see, the heart doesn't grieve about. So then we moved from there, and we moved down to, when I say we, I'm speaking for my squadron. We moved from there down to a little place called Metelin, M-E-T-E-L-I-N, Metelin. It would be about 16 kilometres from the Dutch border of Enschede and Bergsteinfurt, the road from Enschede down to Bergsteinfurt and on into Munster. There we were policing the area, and there we did come across displaced persons. There's a camp not so far away where 14 of these chaps had broken out and gone into a German farmhouse, shoved them all downstairs into the cellar, looted the place, gutted it, and the whole 14 had ravaged a young girl of some 15 years of age that was upstairs in bed with TB. And then they shot her when they left. So that was a blot.
Were they caught?
Oh, yes, eventually. But they, I don't know, it wasn't us. We went looking for them, but I think it was the special investigative branch or something, the security. They got them.
What nationalities were they?
They were displaced persons, Ukrainian, Russian, or whatever. Now, this went on until early January of 46. We came home as a regiment back to Chipnam Park in Newmarket. We had an old comrades reunion when all the old veterans came, some showing their assegai scars from the Boer War and so on. And that was a thrill to meet them. We met our old colonel in chief, General Carton DeWitt, who was badly wounded in the First World War, got the VC, and in the Second World War, he wound up in Colditz. So we had somebody to look up to there. We had, that night, I remember Terry Thomas was just making his mark as a comedian, and he had the place in an uproar. But early April, as I say, we moved out as a regiment after having said goodbye to several of the older men because they were being demobilized and an influx of younger soldiers. We moved out to Tilbury on RMS Corfu.
Was this still 45?
46, April 46 now. As I explained, we came home.
April 46, yes.
We went out to Port Said in Egypt and then down onto the canal zone at Fayed. There we were just in tented accommodation. We'd left our tanks behind and just for a little while we were doing infantry schemes just across the desert, just to keep our hand in. But we moved across the Sinai into Palestine in the June. We took over, again, I must say we as Sea Squadron, we took over a naval camp in Allenby Road. They were moving home, and it was ideal for our situation. B Squadron would be stationed out at Tiberias, A Squadron at Rosh Pinna, and HQ would be at Afula on the Vale of Jenin and about 5 miles from Nazareth. By now we had the armored cars, and our function was to patrol the area and escort these poor people that had been in concentration camps and who were trying to come home, whatever means possible, Cyprus, and then trying to get across on anything that would float. They were being rounded up and put into Z-craft, which in point of fact were LCT with barbed wire around them. There were soldiers there squirting them with DDT, and I used to sit in the harbour in my armoured car thinking, what am I doing here? My job finished on the 8th of May, and to see these poor souls being herded off these ships, little bundles, starved, emaciated, being put on buses, and then it was part of my function to escort these coaches down to a clearance camp by the name of Athlit, south of Haifa. Another of the functions was to go out on patrol, reporting on my brief was to report in every quarter of an hour to my HQ, and we were also on the same wavelength as the Palestine police, For example, hello, Abel, 4, message for Abel, square 4, nothing to report. And then move on to another district. On occasion, we would meet outside Haifa East Station at 8 o'clock at night and rendezvous with a sergeant of the CID. One chappie by the name of Sergeant Price will ever live in my mind. He had a photogenic mind. We would be doing a roadblock, stop a bus, and he would say, well, we'll take him, we'll take him, we'll take him, even though these Jews were disguised as just as Arabs. A wonderful chap, absolutely fearless. I remember one night meeting him with a section of the East Suris, and we did a raid on an hotel in Herzl Street. This is in the main thoroughfare. He went in up to reception, told the girl to keep quiet, not to touch the telephone, and he knew exactly which room to go to, and he took the key with him. And as we went up these stairs, we left a soldier on each landing. We went to this room, let himself in, and we searched the place, and we found guns and ammunition on the 6 beds that were in this room. And there were Stern gang leaflets, all kinds of propaganda, so he said, well, this is the place. And I said, I want you to go. And if you haven't heard from me by 10:30, I'd like you to give a mayday. And this was when we called the whole company of the East Suris out. So I went back and did the rounds, and I kept asking control if they'd heard anything from X. No. So 10:30, I couldn't wait any longer. This is what I did. I mayday. So they put the East Surrey company came round. I went dashing up these stairs, and there above the door was a fan light which was illuminated. Banging on the door, he said, come in, it's open. And there he sat with his across his knees with the Sten gun, and there are six fellas with their hands up against the wall. Three of them had 25 and 30,000 pounds on their head. I said, how long have we been like this? He said, since 10:15. And he might just have been sat on Brighton Beach, totally relaxed.
This was in Haifa?
Yes. So we shipped them off. And a few days later, it was a Sunday, we were in the car park at the camp, heard a burst of machine gun fire off Carmel Avenue, which was the main road that went up Carmel. And we hopped into the cars and shot out, only to find the Sergeant Price, who lived in a little cul-de-sac, had walked to the end of that cul-de-sac and turned to wave at his wife and 2 children that were leaning over a balcony, and he'd been riddled with bullets. Now that was a tragedy. On the lighter side, putting all that on one side, I must say that I enjoyed my time in Palestine. To say that I was able to go to Bethlehem Christmas Eve on the night of nights, to swim in the sea at 5:30 in the morning and in lieu of PT, to go back to the beach when you're off duty for 2 o'clock, to play cricket for the regiment, rugby for the regiment, and hockey for the regiment. I enjoyed my time in Palestine. We seemed to get on pretty well with the inhabitants, but it was a similar situation as one has in Northern Ireland today. It could happen any time. You never knew who was carrying the gun. Usually it was the females. and the females were as dedicated as the men. We'd gone up at 2 o'clock in the morning up Herschel Street with a section of the East Surreys, and there isn't, apart from illuminated windows, we were looking for these little newsletters that they used to slap on the windows and the walls. And not a thing to be seen. By the time we've turned round, the whole street's been covered in them. That was the situation. In between times, we went up across the Jordan Valley into Jordan. And as we went across the River Jordan, it was quite a sight to look up and see way above your head a big white board with a blue line and said that's sea level. We went out to Mafraq, and there, just before Christmas, we had several schemes. A, training the younger end of our squadron, and also King Hussein was taking the opportunity for training almost for real with the Transjordan Frontier Force and his Air Force. We had these schemes out in the desert. So that was quite something. Late December, I relinquished my armoured car and just took on the role of popping up into Nazareth at 7 o'clock in the morning. By this time we'd moved to Afula and to collect Arab labour for the camp. I had to pick up seven Arabs at 7 o'clock in the morning and bring them back for the day. And I left on the 8th of January for home.
47.
Yeah. We came, there were 3,000 on board, outside on RMS Orduna. I think the only thing that was holding the thing together was some metal strips, because it was in a shocking state. It had three engines. There were 3,000 men on board. 24 hours out, they put the starboard side out of action, so we had a port list. 24 hours later, they painted the port side, so the starboard side had a list. Three engines it had. The first, and we set off with one engine running. As we passed Corfu, they got the second engine going, and by the time we got to Jib, they managed to get the third engine going just to get through the bay. And that was a torrid experience too. We came home to Liverpool. Unfortunately, there was no coal at Strensel, so we had to stay on board this boat in Liverpool, miserable, could see home, thick snow. That was a bad winter of 47. And eventually we got off. I was demobilised, and how glad I was to hear that porter as we entered Gargrave Station shout, "Gargrave!" I threw my kit out and braced myself for a little drop from the onto the platform from the carriage. But this clown of an engine driver had gone too far in front, and I dropped off the edge into about 10 feet of snow off the end of the platform. I walked down the wall tops because there was 10 foot of snow on the main road. And, of course, within days, I went down with a chill. Now, Mum was cosseting me, bringing my breakfast to bed and the Daily Express and the Woodbines, and I got the shock of my life. There was a single half column saying that the 4th 7th Sea Squadron, the 4th 7th Royal Dragoon Guards, had been called out on a flap. There was a point car, i.e. a lead car. The colonel decided to enter into this, and then the squadron cars were lined up behind him. I'd handed that car over to a young man by the name of Corporal Fleming, Speedo Fleming, who came from Ulverston. He'd been in the 22nd Dragoons, and he'd from D-Day, he'd never had a scratch. The driver was a young man by the name of Tommy Hutchison. He was 19 and came from Kirkcaldy in Scotland. He was the driver. That car was blown up by what looked to be a milestone. But in fact, it was a pile of dynamite, and that car was blown into the ditch, and those two lads were burnt to death. The number of that car I shall never forget. It was F69720. And there, but for the grace of God, go I.
You would have been in it?
Yeah. Now, to wind all this up, I thank him. I thank the good Lord every night, because he has certainly looked after me since the 20th of August, 1942.